Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking with the authors of a brand new book, Globalization and Empire, The U.S. Invasion of Iraq, Free Markets, and the Twilight of Democracy. We'll be talking with Stephen John Hartnett and Laura Ann Stengram today on Media Matters, discussing these issues, the fate of the world, what it means for us, and what can be done about it. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Mergers amongst telecom providers and cable providers are the media consolidation of the new century. If the media consolidation of the last century was radio, newspapers, TV, we're now seeing the stakes get so much higher, where we're talking not just about outlets of information. We're talking about conduits of all content going into the future.
That's Free Press Research Director Russell Newman speaking about the proposed merger of Bell South with AT&T and the carving up of bankrupt cable provider Adelphia among the two largest cable companies in the country, Comcast and Time Warner. Not only will these acquisitions make the biggest phone and cable companies even bigger, it will result in AT&T, Comcast, and Time Warner controlling more than half of all broadband data connections in the country. Newman says in the face of what these firms have been up to recently, there's more than enough reason to try and stop these deals.
They're already fighting to shut down the internet via neutering net neutrality. They're raising prices while keeping empty promises about serving all Americans. They're handing over personal information about many folks to government eavesdroppers, and now they're asking the government to help them get even bigger.
The FCC is expected to take up the Comcast, Time Warner, Adelphia deal within the next month or two, while its proceeding on the AT&T Bell South merger has just begun. So far, more than 40,000 public comments have been filed in both dockets. The majority ask the FCC to nix the deals or impose strong conditions on them to prevent the companies that stand to benefit from leveraging their market powers to the detriment of everyone else. Newman says the avalanche of public interest in these deals has definitely made the FCC think twice about rubber stamping such transactions.
This should have gone through a long time ago. By the end of last summer, we were expecting to have already lost this thing, and the fact that it's dragged on till now speaks volumes about, you know, what can happen when folks lend their voices to debate like this.
Public broadcasting is back on the chopping block in Congress. Earlier this month, a subcommittee of the House of Representatives voted to slash more than $100 million from the budget of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a cut of nearly 25% from current funding levels. A week later, the House's full Appropriations Committee reduced the proposed cutback by $20 million, but the loss will still spell the end of several of PBS's educational outreach initiatives and may force smaller public radio and TV stations to close their doors. A Republican proposal to do away with all federal funding of public broadcasting by the end of the decade remains in play.
Losing the fight for internet freedom in the House of Representatives has not daunted the grassroots coalition working to get meaningful provisions protecting network neutrality endorsed by the Senate. In the last week, supporters of net neutrality delivered a petition with more than a million signatures to Capitol Hill asking the Senate to support the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, a bill with bipartisan sponsorship. But it's still an uphill battle. Phone and cable companies are flooding D.C. with hundreds of lobbyists, and key senators who control the fate of telecom-related legislation are still not convinced that network neutrality is such a big deal. Tell that to Craigslist, a member of the Save the Internet Coalition. Since February, users of Cox Cable Internet services have found it nearly impossible to access Craigslist.com. Cox blames third-party security software for the problem, though Cox supplies this software to all of its subscribers as part of its service. While all parties realize there's a problem, there is still no fix. Earlier this month, subscribers to Bell South's broadband service found their access to MySpace and YouTube temporarily blocked for about a day. Bell South blamed the problem on a misconfiguration. According to an unofficial tally of where senators stand on network neutrality, 13 have declared support for the principle, while 5 oppose it. 34 senators claim to be aware of the issue but will not yet take a position on it, while it's anyone's guess where the remaining 48 stand. You can find out more about the upcoming battle for internet freedom in the Senate by visiting SaveTheInternet.com.
Universal Music Group, the largest major label conglomerate in the music business, becomes the third company to admit to radio payola and settle an ongoing investigation into the practice by the state of New York. According to the $12 million settlement, several of Universal's labels plied radio stations with cash and gifts in exchange for artist airplay. They also hired people to call stations with song requests. This represents the largest payola settlement to come out of New York's ongoing investigation. Last year, Sony BMG settled with the state for $10 million, and the Warner Music Group paid out $5 million. Probes into the radio side of the scandal continue.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today, my guests are Stephen John Hartnett and Laura Ann Stengren, the co-authors of a brand-new book, Globalization and Empire, The U.S. Invasion of Iraq, Free Markets, and the Twilight of Democracy, a book that just came out in the past month from the University of Alabama Press, to considerable acclaim. Looking at the back cover, a very nice endorsement from Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine, among others. And we're fortunate to have the guests in the studio with us today. We're taping this show a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't call in. Just sit back and relax and let us do the talking. Stephen Hartnett is an associate professor in the Department of Speech Communication here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Co-author Laura Stengren is a doctoral candidate in speech communication at the University of Illinois. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. Steve, why don't you start with the book? What's the point of the book? Why did you write it, and what's the basic argument?
Well, first of why we wrote it, I started writing this book about half an hour after I first learned about 9/11. It was clear to me that my nation
would... You should have called it 9/11 and a half.
It was clear to me that my nation would respond to 9/11 by waging imperial wars of vengeance. And so from the minute 9/11 happened, I knew that I had to do whatever small part I could to track what my nation was about to unleash upon the world. And so for me, the book started as a way of trying to make sense of what my nation would do as response to 9/11. And so for me, that took then first tracking the lies about the weapons of mass destruction and why we went into Iraq. It meant thinking about why we went into Afghanistan and what the links were between Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda. And then when Laura joined on the project, we then expanded it to say, so let's move from first thinking about why we went to war in Iraq to the larger global implications of U.S. foreign policy. And we realized we couldn't make sense of U.S. foreign policy without making sense of the economics of globalization, which then became the third chapter. And then to bring in the lies that led to war, U.S. foreign policy, and globalization all to a head, we wrote a fourth chapter on the crony capitalism involved in the reconstruction of Iraq. So what we hope we've done is provide our readers with a roadmap of post-9/11 U.S. tragedies.
Now, Laura, there are a lot of books that cover this turf. I mean, probably several of them have been featured on this show in the past 3 years. What does this book do, Globalization and Empire, that's different? I mean, what's the value added do you think the two of you are bringing to this task that won't be found in other books?
Well, I guess when I was hired as a research assistant and started working on this project, it was summer of 2003, and so much was going on. We had the war in Iraq. We had the official end to the war and the occupation beginning, and just newspaper articles and public discourse and so much information available that I was looking at while I was researching. And then at the same time, the kind of academic debate was going on about globalization. Have we turned to empire? Joseph Nye's Paradox of American Superpower comes to mind. And so I guess what's different about this book is it engages in those more elite academic debates while having a good hold on the everyday, day-to-day Iraq stuff.
You know, as I read the book, you've done a voluminous amount of reading. I mean, for listeners who are interested in sort of a survey of the literature, have covered just a massive range of issues on militarism, globalization, economics. You've really covered it, and not just recent stuff, but really for a generation of material. I urge it at that level. Steve Hartnett, how would you describe the methodology? What is a work of research, for our listeners' sake, is this a historical document? Is it quantitative analysis? What is the methodology employed?
Well, that's a great question.
Maybe that's why they pay me the big bucks.
My sense is that a lot of the books that have been written about the Iraq War, you can break them down into certain genres. And one genre is that the whole thing's a big conspiracy hatched by a handful of men in D.C. And those books don't care about global economics. Those books don't care about the military-industrial complex. Those books don't care about public discourse. Another genre of books is that they look only at the president's speeches, as if the president were pulling the levers of the government. And we know and we prove in the book that, in fact, that's actually not the case. He's a mouth person for the military-industrial complex. Military experts look at military information but don't look at public speeches, don't look at global economics. So there's these series of genres of people who look at parts of the puzzle but not the whole puzzle. Mm-hmm. So what we've done methodologically is to say you must know the interior workings of the military-industrial complex. You must know about what the World Bank is doing. You must track congressional hearings. You must also consider the president's speeches. That's all part of the big puzzle. So what we really want to provide is a bird's-eye view that merges multiple genres of analysis. So the book is historical. It is rhetorical. It's also very deeply concerned with the inner workings of the military-industrial complex. So we're revealing a lot of secrets. A lot of our sources come straight from the CIA and the State Department, documents that were leaked as the war went badly and as elites in Washington tried to kind of slowly but surely leak out information so that people like us could make a critique of the Bush administration. So the book merges public and private documents, secret and public documents. So we really try to give a bird's eye view crossing genres.
Well, is there a core argument to the book? I mean, you say you come up with some new material on the military-industrial complex and some revelations and you're linking stuff together. Is there a core argument here? What would you say what do you come up with here that most Americans might not know that you think is important that they do know?
I think the key thing that we discovered, the thing that was most disheartening to me, was the remarkable extent to which the military-industrial complex is now driving the cart of U.S. foreign policy. And every time the president
what is the military-industrial complex? A term used widely, but what do we mean by that?
It's a term that's used widely. What it means is very simply that in the 2006 United States federal budget, more than 50% of our tax dollars are being spent on weapons. So 50 cents on your tax dollar is being spent on weapons. When making weapons becomes the most profitable industry in the country, that means making war will become a permanent part of the economy. So we are now in a position where the United States government's chief function is to sustain global wars. And what we find in our rhetorical analysis is that those wars will be justified now by saying things like, oh, it's a war against terrorism, or, oh, it's a war to extend democracy or to protect us, to protect free markets and so on. So what we're finding is a symbiotic relationship between a new age of propaganda coming out of the White House and the military-industrial complex driving U.S. foreign policy.
Laura Sternum, is this a new age, though? Last week on Media Matters, our guest was Stephen Kinzer, the longtime New York Times foreign correspondent, in his book, Overthrow. And what he did in that book is he looked at the 14 occasions in the past 108 years that the United States has actually overthrown other governments, up to and including very recent overthrows in Iraq. And in each case, he says that you have, I think, supporting your claim, Steve, and we say in the book that there are clear material interests that drove this. There's usually, almost in every case, there were specific corporations that wanted to see a government overthrown. But this was never known to the public. There was always a layer of propaganda about democracy and liberation and human rights that was spread to the public. And there were also sort of geopolitical concerns about the needs to protect U.S. interests. But underneath it, he said, always were these economic factors that really drove it in the end. I mean, so is this a new thing that we're talking about that's going on since 9/11, or is this just more of what the United States has had since it's become a dominant, if not the dominant, power in the world and exercised the prerogatives of great powers going back to the time of Greece and Egypt?
I mean, I think that there are historical examples, but what is happening today is pretty unprecedented, looking at the numbers. And then you mentioned, you know, what the public knew and what was secret. The amazing thing now is that we have access to so much information. And so the more heartening thing for me is that there are all these think tanks and different groups that we cite and different documents and papers that we used, right, to find what people said about weapons of mass destruction, for example. The CNS, Center for Nonproliferation Studies, the CRS, Congressional Research Service, the CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and on, these different think tanks and different groups are bringing so much information about war contracts and about big companies to the public. And so one thing I think that we want to do is make this information available to people.
Give us a taste of what you're talking about, and you can chime in here too if you want, Steve Hartnett. What sort of stuff did you find that, about this military-industrial complex, about these firms that most Americans wouldn't know, that explains a lot of what's going on in the world, but that's sort of, you know, kept in the dark for most Americans?
I think the thing that would really outrage most Americans, particularly conservatives, who believe in small government, who believe in reducing taxes, who believe in transparency of government. What would really outrage those listeners is to know that almost all of these military contracts and the vast majority of the reconstruction contracts in Iraq occurred behind closed doors, no congressional oversight, and no open bidding. So this means that KBR, Halliburton, Bechtel, the major corporations, literally would go into a room, close the door. In many cases, we found that the corporations actually wrote their own contracts, which then USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, would then sign the contract without vetting it and without passing it by any kind of congressional authority. So these are basically sweetheart deals happening behind closed doors. These are to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars.
You know, one of the things that comes through in your book, and I think is not a surprise to Americans today at all, is that at this point, I mean, the occupation of Iraq since the invasion in 2003 has proven to be, by I think all accounts now, a disaster or catastrophe from U.S. managerial perspective. In fact, the occupation of Iraq has proven more difficult for the United States than the Nazi occupation of Norway during the midst of World War II, when it had troops spread all over Europe fighting the Soviets and the Allied troops. It was able to occupy a country like Norway more successfully, with Norwegian support, as successfully as the liberation of Iraq. And this is something Americans have had a lot of trouble reconciling. How can we be liberating a country and then not be where the flowers and the poems and the back rubs and the foot rubs?
Well, here's a great story about the way propaganda rebounds upon itself. Your listeners probably remember during the first Gulf War, when the U.S. troops...
Wait, you think my listeners are that old? Okay, what are you talking about?
When the U.S. troops first went into Kuwaiti City to, quote, liberate that city, they were greeted by hundreds of thousands of Kuwaitis lining the streets waving U.S. flags. This became an international symbol of democracy.
Yeah.
And as we went into Iraq, President Bush and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and so on assumed that when we went into Baghdad, we would be met there as well by Iraqis waving U.S. flags. The problem is that those hundreds of thousands of flags that greeted us in Kuwait City were brought to that group by the Rendon Group. This is a private propaganda firm contracted to the U.S. government. George Bush, the senior, contracted Rendon to do that in the first Gulf War. And when his son then invaded Baghdad, he took his father's propaganda as reality, forgot that it was propaganda. Mm-hmm. And so Americans were told that when we show up in Baghdad, we'll be greeted with guns and roses and so forth. But that was propaganda from the first war.
Mm-hmm.
And so in fact, what we were met with, as you could have expected had you thought about it for 5 minutes, we were met with people who do not want to be colonial subjects.
We're talking to Steve Hartnett and Laura Stengram, the co-authors of Globalization and Empire, The U.S. Invasion of Iraq, Free Markets in the Twilight of Democracy. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. Globalization of Democracy is a brand new book just published by the University of Alabama Press. So go look for it in fine bookstores or online or wherever you purchase your books or look at books nowadays. This show was pre-recorded a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back and relax. There's a lot in this book. It's very meaty, and we've got a lot to talk about. Laura Stengram, your special area of expertise, as I understand it, what you're doing your dissertation on, is corporate globalization, trade deals, and the relationship of these phenomena with globalization and militarization, which is, as you said, I think one of the unique contributions this book tries to make. What is that relationship? What's the relationship of free markets and invading and taking over countries like Iraq?
Well, I've looked in my work actually a lot at NAFTA and kind of post-Cold War discourses of free trade and globalization. And so for the Clinton administration, NAFTA was the beginning step to this global village, and there would be world peace, and it would all happen if we tear down our, you know, tariffs and anything that's hurting free trade. And the same was the case actually before the Cold War. At the end of World War II, people were saying the way out of this war is to establish what they called an international trade organization. and a World Bank and an IMF.
Yeah, I mean, just to interject here, I mean, the whole idea coming out of the Cold War, as I remember, the early 90s into the mid-90s of globalization, territorial threats between nation states would be diminished, that
right.
we'd all be one happy market, and we'd survive, much like the 50 states of the United States, but it'd be the global level.
Right. And so then 9/11 happens, and we see that some of the same what we call rhetorics or discourse about neoliberalism or neoliberal discourse is being used, but it's a cover for, you know, policies where private companies are given backdoor deals, right? So they say that there's maybe competition among military contractors because that's a free market, but the case, you know, the fact of the matter is that there isn't. And so a lot of the same global neoliberal discourse still exists,
mm-hmm.
but in this case, it's a new era. It's no longer the same post-Cold War stuff we heard from the Clinton administration.
Well, and let's take that to NAFTA, for example. Since
okay.
NAFTA has been passed in Mexico.
That was back in early 90s, mid-90s?
93. Since then, 8 million Mexicans have fallen into poverty. Manufacturing wages have dropped 15%. Wages for salaried workers has dropped 23%. The Mexican national debt was $57 billion before NAFTA, and it's $100 billion now. So what NAFTA has done is contributed to the impoverization of Mexico. Now, Mexicans, because of a lot of various cultural factors, are not joining Al-Qaeda yet and are not staging in revolutions against the U.S. But when these same economic catastrophes are bestowed upon Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Indonesia and the Philippines, and what you have is globalization in the name of free markets creating massive groups of people willing to raise arms against us. So globalization is fueling international revolution.
We're talking to Stephen Hartnett, Laura Stengram today on Media Matters. Again, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Their new book, Globalization and Empire, that we're talking about, again, pre-recorded show a couple weeks before we went on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, let us do the talking. You know, the Iraq War was perhaps one of the most hyped wars ever, at least certainly in memory, in terms of the buildup. And the core legal case for it was weapons of mass destruction. I mean, there were other things that were occasionally floated, but that was the actual legal reason why we had to go in, because there was the threat of an imminent attack from Iraq upon us, so we could make a preeminent charge against them to neuter their power and overthrow that government. What's your take on that in this book? How do you deal with the issue of weapons of mass destruction in that claim?
Well, one of the things the Bush administration has done, and this is, you asked before, Bob, about other historical precedents to this, and one of the things that almost every U.S. administration has always done is every time there's a foreign policy catastrophe, they need to pin the tail on the donkey. And the CIA is usually the group that gets the tail pinned upon it. So since the war, it's become clear that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We know now definitively that they were destroyed by aerial bombardment in the first Gulf War and then caught by UN inspectors after that war. Bush nonetheless decided to lie and say they were there, and when he was caught, he then said it was the CIA's fault. So one of the things we've done is we've untracked this intelligence turf war within Washington, where
mm-hmm.
as the CIA becomes increasingly outraged at being attributed for having provided false information, which they did not, they increasingly leak more and more documents proving that Bush lied.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we've done in the book, in fact, as far as I know, it's the longest deconstruction of the administration's lies about weapons of mass destruction. We track the president's claims versus what the actual CIA documents say. And it's very clear that from way back before the war, we knew there were no weapons of mass destruction there. And the best example of this, I remember, your listeners, I'm sure, remember the Downing Street memo. The Downing Street memo was released to the Sunday Times in London. It's a memo from Richard
Dearlove. And Downing Street, of course, referring to the residence of the Prime Minister of Britain, like the White House of Britain.
Right. And Prime Minister Blair wanted his top guys to feed him the information from Washington. And so Richard Dearlove, their head of MI6, their version of the CIA.
This is back before the invasion.
This is before the
2002.
War.
2002.
This is the summer of 2002.
Okay.
Right? 9 months before we invade. Dearlove goes to Washington, meets with Bush, comes back and writes a memo to Prime Minister Blair. And the memo says, quote, "Military action is now inevitable. Bush wants to remove Saddam through military action justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. The intelligence and the facts are being fixed around the policy. So this is the head of British intelligence 9 months before the war saying, these guys are lying.
Mm-hmm.
So we track that and we try to prove that. We try to really give readers the empirical evidence to see where and how the Bush administration lied.
Now, Laura, the Plame case has come up. Is part related to this. Mm-hmm. Valerie Plame and her husband, Joe Wilson. How does that factor into all this?
Well, in spring of 2002, Wilson was commissioned. Joe Wilson was commissioned to go to Africa and find out if Nigerians were selling "quote unquote" yellow cake. We heard about.
And this is some stuff that helps you make bombs. I take it
right, as well as uranium to Iraq. And so he went. He found out that no, in fact, they aren't. He told the CIA. He told the State Department. They never claimed to have gotten their phone calls or memos or whatnot. And so he said, and this was spring of 2002, that no, we're not getting, or Saddam's not getting uranium from Nigeria. So by 2003, that's the Bush's State of the Union address in 2003 is when he made the famous claim that Saddam is seeking, you know, nuclear programs from Africa. So after that, there was a smear campaign against Wilson. He had an article in the New York Times in 2003 then saying, no, you know, these claims are wrong. And later that summer, within weeks, within days, the name of his wife, Valerie Plame, was leaked and blew her CIA cover, which is illegal, right? So there's a smear campaign.
It's very illegal if there's such a term. Isn't it like considered, like there's a special law that was passed?
It's a federal crime. Yeah. It's a federal crime to release the name of a CIA covert agent, which they did in order to...
It's a felony, isn't it?
It is. And that's why now the Plame investigation has become so hot, because these are impeachable offenses. You've got a Bush White House engaging in a public smear campaign against one of its own officials by releasing the name of a CIA agent to discredit a critic of the administration. So these are impeachable offenses. And there's also a comic element. Laura mentioned that when Wilson came back from Africa, the first thing he did is he wrote his memo, and he sent it first to his boss at the Africa desk of the CIA. He sent it to the State Department, and he sent it to Stephen Hadley, who was then working under Condoleezza Rice. He was Assistant National Security Advisor. So the White House received a memo from the agent saying no sale of yellowcake uranium. They then went ahead and lied about that in the State of the Union address. Wilson called them on it, and when asked, Hadley said...
This is meteorologist Ed Kieser with a quick weather bulletin. The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, and Shelby counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 8 p.m. We'll have more at the top of the hour. Now back to Media Matters.
Contradicting their war chance, they just happened to lose the memo.
We're talking to Stephen Hartnett, Laura Stengram today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing their new book, Globalization and Empire, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, Free Markets in the Twilight of Democracy, published just last month by the University of Alabama Press. Stephen Hartnett is an associate professor of speech communication here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, the author of Democratic Dissent and the Cultural Fictions of Antebellum America. Laura Stengram is a doctoral candidate in speech communication at the University of Illinois. And Laura, you're about to finish your PhD, is that right?
Yep,
Within a year. Mm-hmm. And your dissertation is on?
It's on rhetorics of free trade prior to the Cold War.
Now, when you're not a grad student, you work here in town at the Independent Media Center, is that right?
Yeah, I've volunteered with The Public Eye, which is a monthly alternative newspaper here in Champaign-Urbana, and it's been just a great experience. I'll write articles occasionally. I sit with the other editors, so we all kind of decide what we want in the paper, mm-hmm. how to lay it out, and work together to edit the thing and distribute it around town.
So anyone who wants to get involved with something like The Public Eye and become a journalist and write, they're welcome to come in and participate. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What would they do if they wanted to do that?
They can email the public eye. They can come to our working group meetings on Thursdays at 5:30. They can show up at the IMC because the IMC does more than just the public eye.
Just in the heart of downtown Urbana in the old post office. What's the web address if people wanted to go to the website and learn more about the public eye and the independent media center?
It's www.ucimc.org.
UCIMC.org. And then you can find public eye and everything there. So just go to UCIMC.org. And for our podcasters who are not familiar with East Central Illinois, I think it's well worth a visit to the website, too, because it's a fairly extraordinary and unusual development here in town to have something like the public eye.
Yeah, it's a great group of people, and we now have a big venue, so there's shows, there's radio shows, there's a video group, there's all kinds of great things going on.
Mm-hmm. Steve, you do some work with over there too, don't you?
Yes, and I'm working now there with a show called Common Sense, a weekly radio program very similar to yours, Bob's, where each
hope
week
it's not on the same time.
No. We're not competitors.
Good.
And each week we merge poetry, politics, and interviews with international activists.
Mm-hmm. So that's on the low power station.
It's on RFU on Tuesdays at noon, and we're on EFT on Mondays at 6 o'clock.
Okay, very good. And let's get back to the book, Globalization and Empire. And there has been, there's so much in this book that we could talk about. And I want to talk about some of the recent developments in Iraq, specifically, and in Afghanistan. But before we do, let's just talk a little bit more about the war on terror, since this is the signal event that drives this book. The conventional wisdom is that a bunch of whacked out lunatic terrorists commandeered a couple airplanes for because they hate our freedoms, and they came in here and tried to make raise hell here, and that now we're in World War III or IV. I don't know which world war we're in, but we're in another world war, and we're fighting for our lives against people who hate us, and, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us, and that's just the way of the world probably for quite a long time. And it's good guys versus evil. And Iraq and North Korea and all these other places like Venezuela aren't fully with us, so they're against us. What's wrong with that narrative, Steve?
Just about everything, Bob.
Okay. I was doing my best. So I scored it 100%.
Nice. You should be the new spokesperson for the White House.
The thing to understand about the war on terrorism is that, I mean, you could track this back as far as you wanted to go in some way. But for the purposes of understanding 9/11, what you have to do is you have to go back to 79, and this is when the Soviet Union is in Afghanistan and the insurgency against the Russians begins. And the U.S. CIA, thinking this will be a way to kill communism.
Let's go back to 73 or 4 or whenever. I mean, there was a mid-70s. A government came into power in Afghanistan. It was closely allied with the Soviets.
Yes.
And then?
Well, then they were installed by the Soviets. It was essentially a coup.
Yeah.
So the Soviets install a communist-friendly regime, which, as so many communist regimes, proves to be utterly incompetent. The people rebel. Civil war begins, and then the Russians invade.
Okay. That's in 79.
That's in 79 when
the puppet regime asked them to come in to support them.
Yes.
Okay.
And the CIA, thinking, aha, this could be the Russian Vietnam, decides, what if we created a guerrilla strike force capable of crippling the Russians? And so the CIA, working with the Pakistani ISI, their version of the CIA, goes in. There was already a Taliban movement in Afghanistan. We go in and through our ties with the Taliban then build a radical guerrilla movement. The chief engineer of that radical guerrilla movement is Osama bin Laden. He's an international contractor. He has access to all kinds of technology. He builds the bunkers that the guerrillas will use to attack the Soviets. So the U.S., Egypt, Israel, Pakistan, and India are all pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into Afghanistan to fuel this Mujahideen movement.
And bin Laden's from Saudi Arabia. He's no more Afghani than Che Guevara was a Cuban.
That's right. And so there we are fueling this international guerrilla movement in the name of destroying communism, which, in fact, they do. But then now bin Laden is on the ground. He's heavily armed. He's heavily financed. And he has a global military. So what do we think is going to happen with that global military?
Mm-hmm.
And bin Laden is an interesting case because bin Laden initially appeals to the governments of Afghanistan and then to Saudi Arabia, saying, look, I've got this army. Put me to good work. And in both cases, they say, yeah, but you're a madman. We don't want you. They exile him. So then he goes underground, and he begins his war on terror.
So he's holing up now in Afghanistan or Pakistan, or we don't know.
It's assumed now that he's in the foothills of Pakistan, which are unpoliceable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also relatively clearly understood that he's being protected by the Pakistani intelligence agency, which is basically running its own foreign policy.
Either historically or currently, or both?
Both. Okay. Historically, Pakistan has done everything it can do to destabilize India. Supporting mm-hmm. Islamic terrorism is an avenue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So Pakistan has always been a close ally with bin Laden. This is, of course, is another one of the great ironies that Americans think Pakistan is our ally in the war on terrorism. That's not true. They mm-hmm. are, in fact, the chief problem.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone that Americans think are our allies are our enemies.
mm-hmm.
The people they think are our enemies were funded by us originally. So this is a classic example of short-sighted foreign policy. You cannot spread billions of dollars of aid and weapons across the globe and not expect it to show up back on your doorstep.
Mm-hmm. A blowback is the mm-hmm. saying they use in the intelligence community. And then 9/11, I mean, there are, you know, I get phone calls and emails and letters, especially emails, all the time from people who think that 9/11 was something that the Bush administration was responsible for, that there was a conspiracy by the U.S. government to do this, sort of a Reichstag fire, that the U.S. government was behind it because it would then make it easier for them to engage in their international policies of militarism without any popular dissent.
Yeah, that's not true. I mean, the Bush administration is run by crass murderers, but there was no conspiracy to 9/11. What there is, it's very simple. The Caspian Sea Basin. Once the Middle East dries up, the Caspian Sea Basin is the future of petrochemicals. They have the largest known oil reserves on the planet.
And what countries are on the Caspian Sea Basin?
Former Soviet republics that have all fallen into dictatorships. Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, all the so-called Stan republics.
But all these countries, if I understand it, they're not we don't have to go democratize them because they're our allies. I mean,
they have given us oil contracts. The problem is that they're all landlocked. So mm-hmm. here we now have set up military dictatorships surrounding the Caspian Sea Basin. We control that oil. We can't get it out.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that's happened in that region of the world is about getting an oil pipeline that will eventually have to go through Afghanistan. So bin Laden and his boys, knowing that that's the future of U.S. foreign policy, decided, what can we do to make the U.S. destabilize its own self-interest? What can we do to make us overreact and ruin our alliances and ruin our credibility?
Mm-hmm.
So they engage in this international program of terrorism, hoping that they could pull us into a global war on terror, because they knew that if they could do that, we'd reveal our hands as fighting wars for oil, fighting wars in the name of empire. So we have essentially fallen into the trap set for us by bin Laden.
And, I mean, to jump ahead if we can, it seems, Laura Stengram, that what was happened in Iraq is the classic case of an occupying army. I mean, it's mm-hmm. there's no liberation whatsoever, but the response of the domestic population has been similar to what took place in all colonial episodes, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Am I missing something? Has there been more liberation there than I've seen?
You know, not that I know of,
mm-hmm.
right? Not that I hear of. It was interesting. Last summer, I worked as an intern for the Carter Center in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
and I looked really closely at the so-called government being set up in Iraq. And so there are, you know, I think it's important for those of us who are critical and who are saying it's a quagmire and a mess, and it is, and it's getting worse, and, you know, sectarian divisions are getting worse and breaking up the so-called Iraqi army. But there are, you know, every once in a while, very tiny steps being made toward some kind of government. And if that government asks the U.S. to leave, the U.S. should leave. And technically, it does have the capability of doing that now, right? And has, mm-hmm. I believe.
Well, what do you think of the case of terrorism and the Iraqi government? Going back to Steve, what you were just talking about, you know, one of the big arguments for invading Iraq was the relationship of Saddam Hussein to 9/11 and to Al Qaeda. Although that was never made officially, it was always weapons of mass destruction for a number of reasons, not the least of which it was. The evidence wasn't very strong.
Right.
But terrorism does seem to be very strong in Iraq today. So were they right? Was Iraq a bastion of terrorism that the United States had to invade to get rid of the terrorism? Is that a good justification for the invasion?
That's one of the bitter ironies of the whole thing, right? Is that there you have an authoritarian regime that will not tolerate terrorism within its national boundaries. We go in, blow up the regime, put our troops in the middle of harm's ways. We have, in essence, put targets on the back of all of our soldiers. So yes, Iraq is now a hotbed of terrorism, but only because we've put our troops in harm's way. If we were to withdraw our troops, you'd see the end of the insurgency literally overnight. The insurgency is coming from a series of different sources. One is the criminal elements in Iraq. Our troops are not capable of identifying those people. So whether we stay or go, the criminal element will still be active. There are some foreign al-Qaeda fighters in Iraq, but they're only there because they're going after our guys. If we took our troops out, then they would have to go elsewhere as well. And then, as Laura said, there's a sectarian strife, and that has been going on ever since that country was falsely created by the British imperial agents as they left. And so that's something the Iraqis have to work out. That's not our business. That's not our duty. That's not our obligation. So whatever terrorism is happening in Iraq today is happening because we are there, and they want us out.
Well, that certainly doesn't explain that we had to invade to get rid of terrorism, if in fact it wasn't there ahead of time or before that. Was there any connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda? I mean, what was the nature of that relationship?
The nature of that relationship was intense animosity. Now, Hussein is a secular, modernizing, authoritarian dictator who wants Iraq to become a Western nation state. Bin Laden is a theological dictator, absolutely opposed to modernization and absolutely opposed to the whole concept of a landed nation state. What Bin Laden envisions is an international jihad. So Bin Laden's worldview and Hussein's worldview, diametrically opposed. We know, in fact, that they hated each other personally. So there's absolutely no connection between those two forces.
We're talking to Stephen Hartnett and Laura Stengram, authors of Globalization and Empire. My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today. I'm coming to you on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're taping this show a couple weeks before going on air, so please just sit back, relax, enjoy the show until we wrap it up here in about 20 minutes or so. Just in the last few weeks, but it's been constant, really, but in the last few weeks, the bombings in Baghdad seem to have picked up. I mean, to the point now where it's not even a news story almost anymore. It's almost like looking at the baseball scores mm-hmm. every day where you expect it. Whereas, 5 years ago, if any of these events had happened anywhere in the world, it would have been above the fold, huge headline. Mm-hmm. 10 Americans killed in a mm-hmm. truck bomb. Now it's just ho-hum, another bombing. I mean, this is extraordinary. I mean, how do we understand this, and is this ever going to end?
Well, your listeners should know there are 4,000 Iraqis murdered in Baghdad this month. I mean, imagine 4,000 New Yorkers being blown to bits in a month, and people would be losing their minds, right? We'd understand that this is civil war, this is anarchy, this is chaos. And as you said, this is kind of back burner news now. So I think the extent of the chaos, it's hard for Americans to know. And one reason we don't know is because we can't see it. The reason we can't see it is because it's too dangerous for Western media to leave the green zone. We have literally created situations so dangerous where the Western media does not dare leave the armed enclave of the green zone.
And it's a pretty small area, this green zone, right?
It's like a large shopping mall with a large wall around it. And so when our reporters get news from the countryside, they're getting it from Iraqi stringers that they have to hire to run out and try to get the news for them. So we literally have no fresh firsthand news coming out of that country, which means that we don't even know how bad the damage is in that country. So that's one thing. The second thing is, will it continue? It will continue until we leave. It's very simple. That we must get the U.S. troops out of that country right now. The insurgency is being targeted against us and our occupation. Now, once we leave, there will still be that sectarian violence, but that's not something we can stop. We can't put the clamps on that.
Well, I follow American politics pretty closely. I know both of you do, and our listeners certainly do in Media Matters. It's striking how that demand you're just making, what you say, follows quite logically from the evidence you present in the book. And I think many of the other guests we've had in the show make the same claim, isn't really playing a very large role in political debate in this country. Our political parties in Washington and our news media, that discussion of complete withdrawal or U.S. responsibility for the situation, not U.S. being a victim, but being an agent that's responsible for creating the situation, is largely absent from official debate in Washington. Even from doves.
No one wants to be soft on the war on terror. Yeah.
I mean, how serious of a problem is this, and what can be done about that?
It's a very serious problem because, as you said, no one in D.C. is willing to stand up and say what needs to be said. We have both parties chiming the party line, which means we're committed now in the long term to letting the carnage continue, to letting U.S. troops be turned into walking targets, to letting 4,000 people a month be blown up in Baghdad. So this is a policy catastrophe. I mean, the word quagmire doesn't begin to summarize how bad a situation we are in that country.
And this is driven, Laura, you think, significantly by economic interests like the Halliburtons and the bomb makers and weapons makers. So I guess they're just cleaning up now. I mean, this is absolutely the total gusher of all time for their bank accounts, what's going on in Iraq.
Well, I mean, I think it's flown in their faces as well, right, because they can't begin to do the reconstruction projects that they claim to do, or have the contracts to do until we're out, we're done. So I don't know why people aren't discussing it. I don't know why even, you know, companies and contractors aren't discussing it.
You know, one of the things that's often held up, and people talk about how bad Iraq's going to say, and the Bush administration does this periodically, say, look, we've won in Afghanistan. We installed a democracy there. Things are working out great in Afghanistan. It took some time, took some patience, but we went in there, we invaded it, we took over, we got rid of the bad guys. It worked just great there. And the same thing will happen in Baghdad. It's going to take a little longer in Iraq, but eventually we're going to get it done. Steve, what is this argument? Is Afghanistan the success story that will be emulated or we should be hoping for in Iraq?
I think that Afghanistan does provide us with a working model for what will happen, although the model is exactly the reverse of what the Bush administration says. If you look at Kabul today, what you see, the city of Kabul in the downtown area is very similar to the Green Zone in Baghdad. It's an armed enclave protected by U.S. troops. Once you leave those walls, Afghanistan is run by the Taliban. They control the countryside. So we're not reconstructing Afghanistan. What we have done is we've let our so-called Northern Alliance allies rule part of the country, and they, of course, as has been established historically for the last 50 years, are the world's largest heroin producers. So in the name of bringing democracy to Afghanistan, what we've done is we've opened the spigot on global heroin trade. And then in the south of the country, it's now ruled by the Taliban. They are resurgent. So Afghanistan is a divided country. The Taliban in the south, armed enclave in the middle, Northern Alliance drug dealers in the north. That's what's going to happen to Iraq. We're going to see the country fracture into feudal fiefdoms controlled by different factions of the country.
And so that's what you see the prognosis is for Iraq as we're looking at it right now?
I think we're going to see clearly the Kurds have a working infrastructure. They have a strong military. They're being aided by Israeli Secret Service. So it seems that the Kurds are going to be able to form a relatively stable nation in the north. And the question now is, will there be ethnic cleansing in Baghdad? And I think that's what everyone is pointing to. So we're going to see the Sunnis and Shiites engaged in a civil war that will eventually rip the country apart.
Laura Stengram, your work, a lot of it's dealt with issues of globalization and free trade. And back, you know, before 9/11, much of the talk was how in a world where there's only one superpower left, there won't be those sort of antagonisms anymore. The Soviet Union is gone, and we'll just have a reign of capitalism and markets, and everyone will benefit by trading with each other. As Thomas Friedman loves to say, people who trade with each other can't have war with each other. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it seems like there's fairly strong evidence that the United States, rather than being the benign leader of sort of a global family of profit seekers, is in fact, you know, finding it's being opposed by China and East Asian capitalist countries like Japan to some extent, and certainly the European Union. I mean, is there now emerging a more clear contention within the capitalist world from this vision of sort of a unitary happy family?
I think so. The recent book that comes to mind is Prestowitz's 3 Billion New Capitalists, or whatever the title is. And he argues that China and India are going to basically be the new economic powers, China in manufacturing and India in services. Mm-hmm. And has a pretty compelling argument that they're taking the U.S. over as the major economic powers.
Well, what do you think, Stephen Hartnett, that means, given the themes of your book, of globalization and empire, the twilight of democracy? You know, if we've got competition, like traditional, we're going back to like 19th and early 20th century competition between major capitalist governments for control over world markets. And we have a massive military-industrial complex, as you put it, that gets over half of our dollars. It's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars annually being funneled by our government into the pockets of industries that exist to make war. That seems like the recipe for a not real pretty picture for the future.
I think that's exactly right, Bob. And even before I go to that, I want to go back to the question you asked Laura. One of the things we do in the book is we spend a lot of time working with Paul Bremer, who your listeners may remember as the chief administrator of the occupying forces.
The initial
wave, yeah, of the occupying force. But before Bremer did that, he was the National Anti-Terrorism Coordinator. And right after 9/11, he launched a new consulting business called Marsh McLuhan Consulting, providing international insurance against terrorism. Hmm. And when he sent out the documents to his prospective clients saying, why might you need international anti-terrorism insurance, he accompanied it with an essay in which he talked about how globalizing neoliberal economics is a recipe for violence. And so one of the things that's so fascinating is that you've got the Bush White House saying in public, globalization is a roadmap for peace, et cetera, et cetera. But privately, amongst global capitalist elites, they realize that what they're doing is creating a global disenfranchised population that will likely want to strike back with force. So even amongst capitalist elites, mm-hmm, I mean, Friedman's just a complete dupe when he says the world is flat. That's what the propaganda wants him to think. But yeah, behind closed doors, they know that what they're creating is an international backlash. So then the question is, so if we then spend 50 cents on the dollar building weapons, how will that help us compete globally? That part of the process, what that will do is it turns us into the world of rent-a-cop, right? And that's how you can explain our relationship with India, for example, now, or our relationship with Saudi Arabia, where we're essentially the hired bully to keep authoritarian regimes in power. Mm-hmm. Trade for that. They'll give us certain trade routes. Saudi Arabia will give us oil, etc. What India is going to do in the future is give us basing rights so that we can bomb the heck out of China if they ever go into Taiwan. So economically, it makes no sense to spend 50 cents on the dollar on weapons. But in the long run, what it does do is it helps us support these authoritarian regimes in the third world that can guarantee control of natural resources down the long road.
What's the payoff for the great bulk of Americans in this arrangement as we become the world's hired security forces and the manufacturing moves to China and the service work moves to India and elsewhere? And a lot of the brainier stuff's going to be going to Europe too,
right,
to their engineers and to East Asia.
Well, that's why.
So,
what does
life in the United States in 2020 look like in this world that's emerging?
That's why part of the book's title is The Twilight of Democracy. And what we're seeing now is we're entering a new age of U.S. democracy where we will technically have the right to vote and we will technically have civil liberties. But within the next generation, what you'll see is the U.S. becoming a divided society. There will be armed enclaves for the super rich, places named Thrush Hollow and Deer Run and all that. And employment will rise. Poverty is already 25% for children under the age of 10. I mean, think about that. We have a higher poverty rate for children in America than in half the known world. So we are rapidly becoming a third world nation.
Wow, that's a daunting subject. Laura Stengram, you're interested in politics. What's the way out of this? What people who read this book, what's the desired response you want people when they put the book and they finish it and put it down? What's the next step you want to see them do?
Well, people need to be able to know that there's a lot out there. So if you're a critical consumer and a smart reader, you can get through the propaganda, right? So that's the first thing. And then I guess at a higher, more political level, the U.S. needs to be on board with international institutions or international alliances, because clearly if we continue in the way we're going, it's going to be what Stephen just described.
And by that you mean following international rule of law, being part of the United Nations and playing by the same rules as other countries? Is that what you're
exactly
getting
at? Right. So we make these rules and then don't follow them on our own, and it comes to backfire on us.
You're listening to Laura Stengram, and we're also here with Stephen Hartnett, the authors of Globalization and Empire. We've only got a few minutes left here today, so sit back and relax. This is a pre-recorded show by a couple of weeks, so if you try to call in, you probably haven't had much luck today. Steve, you want to add something?
Well, I was going to say, take the World Trade Organization as a classic point, where World Trade Organization was initially launched by the U.S. as a way of rationalizing part of the global economy. And then as the rest of the world began contributing ideas of what that might look like to make the global economy more fair, then suddenly the U.S. started opting out of WTO agreements. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't want to become a nation that is a global bully abroad with economics that make us look like a third-rate tin pot country at home, then we need to both renew our democratic practices, we need to make a fairer economy at home, and we need to participate in these global economic structures. We need to push an idea of fair trade rather than free trade.
You know, Stephen Hartnett, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, for most Americans living in a city, reading their daily newspaper, watching the evening news, maybe getting Time magazine, and maybe watching one of the cable TV news networks. That's their media diet. And that'd probably be a pretty small percentage of Americans who would do all those things. So they'd be like the most informed. They would probably think you were on mescaline or something. Mm-hmm. That you were like, what world are you describing? Because it's completely absent in the mm-hmm. media that most Americans consume as their standard media.
Right. That was Chomsky's famous phrase, that it sounds like news from Neptune.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what? How do you – I mean, is that – where does the media factor into the argument of your book?
Well, I know, Bob, you're so active on this front, and your group Free Press is a great group for helping us understand how the media perpetuates this kind of mythology that everything is going well. One thing I'd say is that if people do get the book, there's an appendix, and the appendix includes the names, information, and web addresses of 137 groups, places where you can get actual information to cut through the media propaganda. So I encourage people to check out that part of the book. Mm-hmm. But as you said, Bob, I mean, clearly we're coming with information that it's taken us 5 years of 8 hours a day to cull together. And clearly if you're watching Fox News, you're not going to get this kind of information. But people need to understand that they have alternatives. I mean, this is the beauty of the web. A couple click strokes and you can listen to the BBC, for example, instead of Fox News.
Yeah, what's your media diet? I mean, what do you consume to stay on top of the world?
Oh, gosh. You know, it depends on your mood. I begin every day by going online to look at the Washington Post, to look at the New York Times, to look at the BBC. From there, I then go to various blogs that I think are very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Which ones?
I think Daily Kos is real good. Mm-hmm. And it's going to sound funny, but a place that I go every day for information is the State Department and the CIA. Mm-hmm. These are lifetime civil servants who loathe what the Bush administration is doing to the country, and they're releasing tons of information every day. So you can go
until they get fired.
Until they get fired. So
or
you can
arrested.
Go directly to the government, yeah. Go to your daily blogs, go to good newspapers, go to international newspapers, and go to your group, go to Free Press. You've got links to everything out there.
Well, Laura, what do you what's your media diet look like?
Public radio, New York Times online, New York Times Sunday because it's nice and cheap. And that usually takes me all week to kind of read the whole thing. Same thing, blogs. Progressive Daily Blog is another one that I read. I like Wonkette. That's mm-hmm. another good blog. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much information out there if you start clicking around and looking for it.
You know, we've only got about a minute left, and I don't want to close the show without talking really briefly, if we could, about the troop massacre that recently Congressman Murtha made an issue out of. And it sort of comes after Abu Ghraib and the various torture scandals. I mean, there is a very dark side to this occupation that's only sketchily known to most Americans. What's your sense of the magnitude of these sort of war crimes that have taken place in Iraq?
Every single day in every state of Iraq. As simple as that. You've got U.S. troops who don't speak the language and don't know why they're there. They're scared as hell, and they're firing first and asking questions later.
And everyone's the enemy, sort of like Vietnam.
There's a story coming out of Haditha. Four college kids are home for the weekend. They drive their car around the corner. A Humvee has just been hit by an explosive. They see the explosion. They put it in reverse to pull away, and the troops, seeing a car in reverse, thinking they must have set the bomb, open fire and kill all four college students who've come home to visit their mother. Those kind of atrocities are happening every day.
Well, on that note. Let's draw this show to an end. My name is Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I'll be back 1 week from today with Eric Bollert from Salon. I want to thank Stephen Hartnett and Laura Stenger for being my guests today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Authors of Globalization and Empire, The U.S. Invasion of Iraq, Free Markets, and the Twilight of Democracy. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. See you next week.